It's Tuesday, March 5th, and it must feel like a Super Tuesday to Donald Trump. We start here. The Supreme Court clears the way for Trump to appear on every state's ballot, even the ones that wanted to kick him off.
They basically said, it's a nationwide election. No, I don't think this is a great idea.
This is just one of a few legal victories for Trump that could alter the shape of this election. We'll walk you through them. For decades, women have had to get a prescription to take the pill. That's about to change.
Many more people will be able to start taking birth control.
A new drug is being shipped to pharmacies as we speak, where it's about to be sold over the counter. And they can't arrest gang leaders. They can't even hold on to the ones they've caught.
There's less than 100 prisoners still left inside. We know that there were nearly 4,000 there to begin with.
Armed men in Haiti just organized a massive jailbreak, and they've got way bigger plans. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Good morning and welcome to Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday always has the potential to be the single most dramatic day of a presidential election year. Remember, this was the day that cemented Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee 4 years ago.
And it was certainly a Super Tuesday for Joe Biden. No question about that. He rode a fast-breaking wave to score a primary comeback beyond any that has come before.
They don't call Super Tuesday for nothing. Count it out. Left behind. This is your campaign.
And today is even bigger than most. There are more delegates at stake than any other Super Tuesday in modern history. Among the states, Alabama, Arkansas, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Vermont, Virginia. Alaska is holding a Republican caucus. And then you got the huge delegate-rich states of Texas and California all up for grabs. This is like the Superest Tuesday. However, unlike 4 years ago or 4 years before that, there doesn't seem to be nearly as much drama today. Between Trump and Nikki Haley, Trump appears to be the overwhelming favorite in all of these contests. In fact, heading into this week, it wasn't clear Haley could win a single state. Unless you consider the two states I have not mentioned yet that are also opening their polls today, Colorado and Maine.
Now to the bombshell ruling from the Colorado Supreme Court disqualifying former President Donald Trump from running in the state's Republican primary for his role on January 6th.
Citing a little-known clause in the Constitution about insurrectionists, each of these two states had declared that Donald Trump's name was not going to appear on their ballots. These decisions were challenged in court. Well, yesterday, the Supreme Court itself, in a unanimous decision, weighed in, saying it is illegal to keep Trump off the ballot this year. Let's start the day with Kate Shaw. She's a law professor at UPenn. She's also our ABC News Supreme Court contributor. Kate, I feel like we could all tell the Supreme Court didn't want mainstream candidates just getting tossed off ballots. Like, you could feel their discomfort. But there is this provision in the Constitution about insurrections, right? So what was the actual rationale from the court yesterday?
Well, that's right, Brad. The text of the Constitution on its face actually does seem pretty applicable here. So this provision of the 14th Amendment disqualifies anyone from holding public office if, after taking an oath to uphold the Constitution, they later engage in insurrection. And the Supreme Court in Colorado and the Secretary of State in Maine took a look at the events of January 6th and said that was an insurrection, and they concluded that Donald Trump engaged in it, and he was therefore ineligible to run to be president again. But of course, Trump appealed that Colorado decision to the Supreme Court. And in the ruling yesterday, the court basically did what I think we all expected after the oral argument last month, which was decisively side with Donald Trump and hold that states actually don't have the power to keep a presidential candidate off the ballot. That's the kind of thing that needs a nationwide solution, if it needs a solution at all. And so maybe Congress could look at keeping someone off the ballot if they engaged in insurrection. But mostly, honestly, Brad, what seemed to be afoot was that the court was really worried about the chaos that would ensue if individual states could do what Colorado had done. So they basically said, it's a nationwide election. No, I don't think this is a great idea.
It's not a good idea for us. But wait, I'm confused, Kate, because now, like, the day is today, right? Like, do they need to print new ballots now that the Supreme Court has overturned the state court?
Actually, no, Brad. So the state court in Colorado ruled back in December that Trump was ineligible and shouldn't be on the ballot, but they stayed their own ruling, and actually the ballots were printed with Trump's name on them. So many, many Colorado voters have already cast ballots, many of them presumably for Donald Trump. And what the state officials in Colorado have been saying is, well, if the U.S. Supreme Court agrees that Trump shouldn't be on the ballot, we just won't count the votes cast for Donald Trump. And I think, again, that was really the sort of deep logic of the decision was that it would just be too chaotic if each state could decide for itself who appeared on the ballot as the presidential candidate. Maybe other states would try to keep Trump off. Maybe there would be tit for tat and red states would try to keep Joe Biden off, manufacturing some notion of insurrection. And so the court just didn't want to go down that path at all and basically said, if Congress wants to address this, that's one thing. But states, you really have no role keeping people off the ballot on this basis.
But so if it seems like the Supreme Court's like, please don't make us like the Bush v. Gore thing all over again. But clearly they have a lot of power over our elections this year. Yeah. Can we talk about the other big Supreme Court decision recently, which was they said they're going to take up Trump's claims of absolute presidential immunity. Usually I would say no one get excited. This isn't even a ruling. They're just agreeing to hear the case at some point in the future. But the reason it seemed like such a big deal now is that it's not the decision everyone's looking at. It's the calendar. How does that play into things?
I think both the decision and the calendar matter a lot. But here, you're right. I think, Brad, the calendar might be the most important thing. So Trump is saying he is absolutely immune from being criminally prosecuted in the case that's pending in D.C. arising out of January 6th. The D.C. Circuit unanimously rejected those arguments, and Trump asked the Supreme Court to take them up. And the court sat on that for a couple of weeks, leading a lot of people to think maybe the Supreme Court was going to just take a pass on this, let the D.C. Circuit have the last word. And that would mean a trial could happen, you know, imminently, basically. Like, they would resume proceedings now and probably a trial could happen in May. But the Supreme Court decided it actually wanted to weigh in on this question of presidential immunity. And it wanted to hear arguments the week of April 22nd. So that's, you know, like 7 weeks from now. So what that means is that the court is going to have to hear arguments, decide the case. Presumably, it will rule against Donald Trump. I think that's what most court watchers think will happen, but it matters a lot when.
Wait, so usually you take up a case if you want to kind of overturn the other court's thing. Here, they're taking it up probably to uphold it, but it also just pushes the can down the road. You almost wonder if, like, if that's the reason they're doing it. Does this raise the possibility that Trump just, like, wouldn't face these federal trials before the election?
It's definitely possible. Now, we still could, if the Supreme Court moves quickly, the trial proceedings could resume. We could still have a trial late summer or early fall. But if the court drags its feet on the decision, it might actually push the calendar until after the election. And just to connect the two cases, the one from yesterday and this next one, I do think one big takeaway is that in the Colorado case, the court moved really, really quickly. So, you know, it was about 3.5 weeks between the argument in the Colorado case and the decision we got yesterday. So if the court wants to, it could move just as quickly, maybe faster in the immunity case, which I think has actually a simpler set of legal issues. So we could get an immunity decision in, say, early to mid-May. And then I think a trial really could happen. But that is really in the hands of the Supreme Court right now.
Wow. Because, yeah, you know that if there's a verdict in any of these federal cases, that it will get appealed to the Supreme Court. Like, we just know that would happen. And then all of a sudden, the Supreme Court would feel like they had to decide who is the president. Like, they don't want to do that, which is where you get all these people being like, why exactly are they making this take so long? All right. Yeah. Kate Shaw, really helpful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start here, let's see, you can get aspirin, toothpaste, and soon birth control, the new item arriving on pharmacy shelves after the break.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
In many ways, women's reproductive rights in this country are as restricted as they've been in decades. States can now ban abortion. Many have. In some of these states, there are risks to even helping someone locate the care that a doctor says they may need. Policies declaring fetuses and embryos or children have created their own complications that we've seen just in the last week or two.
As an infertility physician, I am used to difficult conversations, but these last 2 weeks have been absolutely heartbreaking.
But in other respects, some reproductive treatments are more accessible than ever. Remember, surgical abortions are becoming less frequent. The abortion pill is far more common, and Walgreens and CVS have announced they're going to start selling it in some states. Other states have outlawed these sales, but those pills are still coming in via the mail. A recent report from the Society for Family Planning, a pro-abortion rights group, estimates that up to 14,000 abortions a month are being facilitated by telehealth appointments. Well, yesterday, in a new development, the makers of a birth control pill say it'll be available in pharmacies over the counter without a prescription by the end of this month. Sony Salzman is with ABC's medical unit. Sony, this drug is called O-Pill, like the letter O and then pill. How significant is this announcement?
Brad, this is a really big deal. And the reason that it's a big deal is because this is the first time that an over-the-counter birth control product will be available in the United States. And right now, birth control is available, like many medications, with a prescription from a doctor or a medical professional that can write a prescription. And, you know, there are reasons for that, but that, frankly, creates a barrier for a lot of people. And so the idea here is that by making this medication available over the counter, it will be easier for people to get, and that many more people will be able to start taking birth control. And that could be really impactful for people who, for whatever reason, are kind of stumped by that barrier of getting a prescription. So the idea is to expand access here and expand access dramatically.
And so this is like, it's the pill. Like when people talk about taking the pill, this is what it is. And yet now it's available without the prescription. You take it the same way.
So basically, O-Pill is a progestin-only birth control. And what that does is it works in several ways to prevent pregnancy. One of the ways is that it thickens the lining in the cervix. The other way is that it stops ovulation. So, you know, it's working in multiple ways to prevent pregnancy. And when taken consistently, progestin-only birth control, like other forms of oral birth control, is kind of in the high 90s percent effective. So 98% when you take it at the same time every day.
And so now, once this becomes available in stores, like who can buy it? Anyone?
Yeah, so it's going to be available in stores. It's going to be $20 a month. If you buy a few months in advance, then, you know, it's a little bit of a discount. And, you know, anyone can buy it. Now, of course, there are certain people who shouldn't buy it. People who've had breast cancer or really any type of cancer should be talking to their doctor. People with kind of these medical concerns, right, that would make them potentially more high risk. But as long as you're able to read the label and, you know, make sure that it seems safe for you and you feel confident, you should. I hope everyone, all of your listeners, feel confident calling their doctor or walking up to the pharmacist counter. If you're in a CVS, for example, you can take the box up to the counter and ask questions. You're always welcome to do that. But you will be able to just buy it, kind of like you do with any over-the-counter product.
And so with that all in mind, Sony, I mean, are there safety risks here? Because I assume, like, that's why women needed to have prescriptions all these years, was you do want a doctor to spot any potential complications, right? But overall, you're saying that the public health benefit sounds like it's going to be much greater than the risk.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the determination that the FDA was grappling with when they were deciding whether to approve this as an over-the-counter medication. And, you know, just some numbers here, almost half of the more than 6 million pregnancies in the U.S. each year are unintended. Mm. And unintended pregnancy can have its own health risks. There's a higher risk of premature birth, and then there's, you know, risks of child health outcomes being worse. So, you know, this is a really heavy decision, right? But again, what the real determination here that the FDA was making is, do consumers know how to read the label? Are they familiar enough with this product? The first birth control product was approved in the United States in the 1960s. So American consumers have decades of, you know, using birth control products, using oral contraception. And what the FDA determined in the data that was brought forward is that they have a good understanding of how to take this safely. What are some of the things to watch out for? When to reach out to that healthcare professional, you know, and when you're having an issue. So that was kind of the determination here.
All right. Really interesting. And again, these are on trucks right now. They're arriving at pharmacies' loading docks, and they will be on the shelves perhaps as soon as the end of the month. Sonny Salzman from our medical unit, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Brad.
Imagine how nervous you'd be if a murderer escaped from a local prison. You don't know where he is. Now imagine how your community would react if a whole gang of people got loose. Not even just gang members. These are the ones who committed crimes worth years behind bars. Well, now imagine if hundreds or even thousands fled a jail on the same day as part of a massive jailbreak. That is what appears to have happened in Haiti recently. We're now seeing massive displays of violence, and gangs there are putting real political pressure on government officials to bow to them. ABC's foreign correspondent Matt Rivers has reported on Haiti extensively. Matt, what is going on right now?
You know, Brad, it takes a lot for me to be shocked about what's going on in Haiti, and yet this I really feel like is an inflection point of sorts. This could be a real turning point in this country. We have seen gangs basically control at least 80%, maybe more, of the city of Port-au-Prince for years now.
So this is damage from a stray bullet.
Yes.
Here, that came in from the street. I mean, you can see.
It was that way when I was there last year, and it's been that way for a while now.
Sometimes you find some bullets on the yard, in the classroom.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of freaky.
But what we've seen happen, really since the middle of last week, is largely unprecedented. We've seen a lot of these gangs who used to war with each other, obviously against the government, but also with each other, vying for economic, political, territory control, things like that. They've unified in a way that we haven't really seen before, against the government, led by acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry.
We ask the Haitian National Police and the military to take responsibility and arrest Ariel Henry.
And it was really the middle of last week, after the acting prime minister said that he was pushing back the elections that were supposed to have taken place already. He wants to push them back until August of 2025, extending his mandate running the country. It seemed to be a kind of red line for these gangs. And they said, you know what, we're going to unify and we're going to start to lash out.
These weapons are our symbol of freedom. With these weapons, we will liberate the country. And these weapons will change the country.
We saw days of violence around Port-au-Prince. We saw multiple police officers killed. We saw gangs taking up arms, attacking somewhere between 20 to 30 different police precincts all around the country. We saw government buildings attacked just 500 meters from the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy has been forced to shut down services.
We are closely monitoring the situation and condemn efforts by gangs to further destabilize and take control of Haiti.
And it kind of came to a head over the weekend. Haiti's National Penitentiary sits in the downtown area of Port-au-Prince. I've been inside this prison. It is one of the worst places that I've ever seen. Overcrowded, thousands of inmates inside, everyone from gang leaders to corrupt politicians to petty criminals, all in an overcrowded space.
And what Haiti would consider the worst of the worst, effectively.
The worst of the worst. It's their most notorious prison. It's their largest prison. It is where all the bad guys have gone over the years.
We were asleep when we heard the sound of bullets. The cell barriers are broken. I'm the only one left in my cell.
What we saw play out Saturday afternoon was the beginning of a coordinated, large-scale attack led by these gangs against the prison. This is a massive prison, high walls, thick concrete, not an easy place to get into, and yet we saw an overwhelming display of firepower directed at that prison. They were able to get inside, and they were able to free, we don't have an official number, but what we do know is there's less than 100 prisoners still left inside. We know that there were nearly 4,000 there to begin with.
What?
So just do that math. The government has not said how many people got
out. Wait, are we talking about, you're saying like more than 3,000 prisoners then, it sounds like.
More than 3,000 prisoners, that is the size of a U.S. Army brigade, more or less.
How does that happen?
It happens because these gangs come in with overwhelming firepower and simply fought their way in. We saw a union representing Haitian National Police officers actually tweet out during the attack for any officer with a car, a weapon, and ammo to come join the fight because those officers were so overwhelmed. The only people, interestingly, that are left, less than 100 prisoners inside, are some of the people who are too scared to be on the streets, and that would include The dozen or so Colombian nationals who were arrested shortly after Haiti's president was assassinated in July of 2021, they were the accused assassins. They're still inside the jail. Everybody else is gone.
It was a very difficult situation last night. The riot in the prison, our lives were at risk.
It's a stunning turn of events. And what we have now is an incredibly destabilizing event because all of these men, and they're all men who got out, are of fighting age. They were freed by gangs looking to bolster their ranks in their fight against the government. And so what you have is a gang complex that now has access to thousands of potential new soldiers to take up arms against the government. And this is why people I'm talking to say when we're talking about gangs, you know, I spoke to a senior official in Haiti who say we keep using the word gang. We should be talking about armed rebel groups because now you've got these groups of people who are well-armed, who are now have the ability to bolster their ranks. And you're hearing from the leaders of these groups saying we're going to continue this fight until the current government is toppled. That's the recipe for a potential civil war. And it's not hyperbole to say that.
Yeah, because I assume Haiti needs, obviously Haiti doesn't have the security forces it needs, otherwise they would have put this rebellion down. Who do they get help from?
Well, so interestingly, the acting prime minister, Ariel Henry, was not even in the country when this went down over the weekend.
What this mission is bringing is hope for the future.
He had left to go to Kenya to sign a direct reciprocal agreement with the Kenyan government to help secure the deployment of a UN-authorized force of 1,000 or so Kenyan police officers to come to Haiti to try and stabilize the security situation. So Ariel Henry went all the way to Kenya to sign this agreement with the Kenyans to say, we need your help. We need these forces to come in to stabilize the country, to increase the security, and to lay the groundwork for elections that could take place in, you know, 18 months or so. He's not even in the country, but he hasn't been able to return yet because the security situation is so bad. So
right,
he's
now
still...
there's 3,000 extra fighters to combat these 1,000 guys he was asking for.
Exactly. And if he were to resign, who takes over for him? That is an unknown at this point. There is no person laying in the wings. There's no number two that would take over. Who takes over? Who governs Haiti? That's an open question at this point. The gangs don't have the answer to that. The United States doesn't have the answer. The UN doesn't have the answer. Nobody has that answer. And that's why this is an incredibly volatile situation. Just a 90-minute flight, let me remind our listeners, from Miami.
Wow, we talked about this as like almost becoming a failed state. Now, everyone who is already behind bars now back out on the street and joining forces against the government. Unbelievable. Matt Rivers, covering Latin America. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, is spring break spring broken? One last thing is next.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
And one last thing. For the political world, today is Super Tuesday, but to the college crowd, we're a couple weeks away from the real parties. Spring break is coming up, and you probably know how you might attract people to your spring break party, right? Warm temps, warm water, a keg or 10. MTV figured out the formula back in the day.
How many college kids can you stuff into a small seaside Florida town? Way too many.
But what if you don't want all these scantily clad revelers arriving on your shores? Well, we're about to find out because this year, the city of Miami Beach is trying to break up with spring break.
And it's not us, it's you.
That is an actual ad put out by city officials in Miami Beach. This past weekend, they started limiting liquor store hours, brought in bigger security teams, and They're closing parking garages. You can't use them. It's suddenly way more inconvenient to gather with your buddies on the beach. The city's even advertising on its official website that it's going to be miserable during March. Quote, expect curfews, security searches, and bag checks at beach access points, early beach entrance closures, DUI checkpoints, and bumper-to-bumper traffic.
Come here, enjoy, but don't come here looking for trouble. We've had enough.
And you can see why Mayor Stephen Miner has had it. The last couple of years, there have been hundreds of arrests, thousands of citations. Last year saw two shootings. The year before, police had to use pepper balls to disperse unruly crowds.
State of emergency in the spring break destination of Miami Beach. The city imposing a curfew following two deadly shootings over the weekend.
But what's Miami Beach's loss could be the rest of Florida's gain. Cities like Fort Lauderdale have said emphatically, we are open for spring break. We're embracing the chaos. They're welcoming college students, same with towns along the Gulf like Panama City. But some of these towns have been instituting curfews for years. They got mounted police on the sand, all of them trying to just invite enough mayhem without driving away everyone else for the rest of the year. We have a producer, Amira, who grew up in Georgia, and she's like, my friends always used to go down to Panama City, Florida for spring break. And we're like, oh, when was that? She's like, oh, back when we were in high school. Like, they tried to start a GoFundMe so I could go, but I couldn't join that. I'm like, which high schoolers are going to these spring breaks? Like, I never went to one of those sorts of things when I was in college. I don't know what the kids are doing nowadays. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.